The Honorable Chief Justice Hardesty presiding.
You may be seated. Good morning. The en banc court begins its oral argument cases this morning with the case of Tamir Hamilton, number 51739, versus the state of Nevada. Ms. Bond, Mr. Petty, who will argue first? Are you going to both argue, or?
We're both going to argue.
All right. You're going to proceed first, Ms. Bond? All right.
Chief Justice Hardesty, honorable members of this court, counsel, my name is Cheryl Bond. I'm with the Washoe County Public Defender's Office, and I'm here this morning with Chief Appellate Deputy John Petty from the Washoe County Public Defender's Office, and we're representing Mr. Hamilton. Mr. Petty will be covering the Batson issue in his argument, and I intend to yield 10 minutes to him for that, and we would like to reserve 7 minutes for our rebuttal. The issue I want to address first this morning is the not guilty by reason of insanity instruction issue, because I'm asking this court to address that law and to rework the way it was stated in Finger versus State. Prior to 1995, the standard for legal insanity in Nevada was McNaught. I had to go back to Cook v. State in 1964 to find it actually spelled out. Subsequent to that, this court said it's a McNaughton test, it's a McNaughton test, and didn't really address it in specific. And in Cook v. State, this court spelled out the classic two prongs of McNaughton, either that the defendant did not know what he was doing, the nature of the act he was doing, or that he did not appreciate the wrongfulness of what he was doing. In 1995, of course, the Nevada legislature removed not guilty by reason of insanity from the statutory scheme in Nevada. And in 2001, this court decided Finger v. State. The court said that the option for acquittal due to not guilty by reason of insanity was constitutionally required, and then set out that the law is still the McNaughton test. However, in Finger v. State, the court added an additional requirement. In addition to the two prongs, this court said that a defendant would not be legally insane unless the facts of the delusions, if true, would justify the commission of the criminal act. That's the section that we're asking this court to remove from the requirements. When the legislature readdressed this, they put in the standard two McNaughton tests. The defendant must prove in his defense of legal insanity either one or the other of those two prongs. Did not include this third element. We're asking the court to issue an opinion removing that element for a couple of different reasons. In Finger versus State, the court said that, gave an example, that if the delusion, for instance, in a murder case was that the defendant was killing an enemy combatant, that that would provide a legal justification and therefore would fit under the McNaughton plus this extra element rule, and they'd be legally insane. But if the defendant merely thought that, according to their delusion, this person was going to kill them in the future, so they hunted him down and killed him first, that would not provide a legal justification and therefore would not fit under the McNaughton plus rule outlined in Finger. That type of distinction doesn't serve a purpose. Both situations would present somebody who does not appreciate the wrongfulness of their act. They recognize they're killing another person, but they don't understand that this is wrong because of their delusion. A person whose delusion is such that they think they don't know that the act is wrong can't appreciate the need for justification. It's a matter of fortuitous circumstances for that person what delusion they suffer. They cannot control what their delusions are. This is not something they're in delusion about by choice. If I think that I'm a U.S. soldier and I think I perceive this as Afghanistan, and I perceive Chief Justice Hardesty as an enemy combatant and I kill him, I didn't choose that delusion. It's the one that I'm suffering under. And under the McNaughton plus rule in Finger, I would have a legal insanity defense. But if I perceive that I'm myself, that we're here in this courtroom, and that six of you are the justices that you are, but under my delusion I perceive Chief Justice Hardesty as not himself, but as an assassin who's been trying to kill me and I've been hiding from for weeks, and just by the skin of my teeth escaping him, and I know at some point he's going to get me and kill him. That would not provide a legal justification under Finger. There's no difference in my state of culpability or my mental state. In both cases, I'm under a delusion, not of my own making. I'm acting pursuant to that delusion, and I don't perceive the wrongfulness. McNaughton already requires that. If I perceive that it would be wrong to kill Justice Hardesty, whether I thought he was an enemy combatant or an assassin, then I wouldn't fit under McNaughton anyway, because I can perceive the wrongfulness of the act. But if my delusion is such that I don't understand that it's wrong to kill him, then adding the element that the facts of my delusion must provide a legal justification don't change my culpability, they don't change the result that he would be dead, and they don't change the fact that I was acting under a delusion. All it does is ask a person who cannot think rationally, who's acting under delusions, to act only if a rational person would act.
Counsel, for purposes of this case, does it make a difference? And if so, explain how.
Yes,
and what you're asking us to change in the present state as you see it.
Yes, it does, Your Honor. In this case, the jury was instructed pursuant to Finger, and they were instructed on the actual element, the third requirement, that the delusion, the facts of the delusion, if true, must justify the commission of the criminal act. One of the problems that can occur with that added element, aside from the fact that there's no real reason to be and no real purpose to be treating the deluded person differently, is an argument that happened in this case. In the final closing argument, and it's in volume 13 of the Record on Appeal, in the PM transcript, not the AM one, the prosecutor argued that as to the sexual assault in this case, the defendant could not be found not guilty by reason of insanity because the facts of his delusion, whatever they might be, would have to justify commission of the criminal act, and you can't justify raping somebody. No matter what your facts are, there's no justification for committing rape. And then, of course, he went on to argue as well that he didn't think that it was true. But he made the argument to the jury, and he argued several times to this jury that they had to apply the instruction that the facts of the delusion must provide a legal justification for commission of the criminal offense.
What do the experts say in relation to McNaughton and to Finger as far as this defendant in this particular case?
The expert was not permitted to testify about whether he thought the defendant was legally insane under McNaughton. The trial court, in and out of the presence of the jury hearing where the expert testified, explained that he could not give an opinion on the ultimate issue of whether the defendant was insane at the time. He did testify that he believed the defendant was suffering a psychotic break at the time of the incident, and that the defendant's psychotic breaks included delusions. The trial court prohibited the Dr. Schmidt from testifying about what specific delusions were, because the only way the doctor knew that was that Mr. Hamilton told him the delusions that he suffered, and the court said that he couldn't tell the jury what Mr. Hamilton had said because it would be hearsay. It was another issue that we also raised in the briefing, that that was an inappropriate restriction, and the expert should have been able to testify to that.
Did the defense argue that this may be a Fox situation, Fox versus State, that because of his mental conditions and tensions and stuff, that he was unable to premeditate this murder? Or is it a foregone conclusion because of the sexual assault? It makes it real hard to argue Fox when you have the sexual assault.
The defense argued not guilty by reason of insanity, that he was under a psychotic break and was not aware of the act of what he was doing. For all the crimes, for sexual assault, for the murder.
But one step below that is Fox, where you say that because of tensions and in his life and because of severe mental illness, although he's not legally insane, he could not premeditate.
No, they went straight with not guilty by reason of insanity. And specifically based it on Dr. Schmidt's testimony that there was a psychotic break, and that Mr. Hamilton was not aware of what he was doing. So it wasn't that he was somehow diminished in his ability to form a particular intent. It was that he didn't even realize the act that he was committing.
Was Schmidt able to say he didn't know the difference between right and wrong, or he didn't appreciate the nature and quality of his act? Was he able to say either of those prongs?
No. He was. There were a couple of different instances where that was addressed. Outside of the presence of the jury, the court told him he could not elaborate on that, and he said he wouldn't. During, I think it was cross-examination, I think The prosecutor was asking him that. I don't know that it was phrased exactly that way. I just don't remember if it was an exact phrasing of that or if it was very close. And it went, they went around because the doctor was trying not to violate the order not to say that, but the prosecutor was asking him directly. And eventually it was not very clear.
But he did tell the judge that he could not make a determination under McNaughton. Am I right? I mean, this happened to me when I was a defense attorney.
Right.
I had a psychiatrist all lined up to tell that my client was qualified under McNaughton. When he got on the stand, he said that he couldn't make that determination. I mean, I almost fell off my chair, but this has happened sometimes in these serious, serious high-profile cases.
No, he said what Dr. Schmidt said was that he couldn't say absolutely what Mr. Hamilton was or was not thinking. He couldn't say absolutely whether what Mr. Hamilton relayed to him was true. He could give his opinion as to why he thought it was, that he was not malingering or making this up. But he couldn't say what Mr. Hamilton was thinking, and it never got pinned down to, well, what did he say he was thinking, or what would you conclude if I just asked your opinion? He said he thought he was suffering a psychotic break.
But he didn't go on further with McNaughton. He used the magic words of McNaughton so that we could really examine Finger. I mean,
right.
You put me in a spot where I don't even care about that the Finger decision. I'm talking about we're not even getting to McNaughton yet, let alone Finger.
The trial court told him in pretrial hearings that he was not allowed to give an opinion on that, and so he avoided it. He did not say under McNaughton I find, or I would find that he had this or this knowledge or did not have it. And he didn't use McNaughton as an explanation at all. So no, that is not present.
Ms. Bond, isn't the problem in the area that Justice Cherry is talking about that Dr. Schmidt's testimony was that Hamilton was not able to relate what occurred at the time of the murder, first, and that he had no memory of the alleged offenses? Isn't that correct? And as a consequence, Dr. Schmidt couldn't offer an opinion under McDonald.
Dr. Schmidt did say that Mr. Hamilton was unable to relate what happened, that he was unable to remember it. But Mr. Hamilton was able to relate other aspects of delusions that he was suffering before, after, and at the time he was at the jail. And Dr. Schmidt was not allowed to even get into those aspects. Mr. Hamilton was able to relate certain points of what happened that evening up to a certain point, and then his memory was not sufficient. And then after a certain point, when he went back into the apartment, and found Ms. Quick, Mr. Hamilton was able to relate that. It was the time in between that he was not able to relate to Dr. Schmidt. So there is a point at which, during the actual event, where Mr. Hamilton's memory was gone, but Dr. Schmidt was testifying based on Mr. Hamilton's relating what happened up to that point and after that point and what had continued to happen, as well as his mental health.
Well, what I got from Dr. Schmidt's testimony as an opinion is that Mr. Hamilton suffered a psychotic episode of some unknown, indescribable nature.
That's correct. He wasn't able to explain. Mr. Hamilton was not able to recall, so he could not say, this is what I was thinking at that exact minute. So Dr. Schmidt could not say at that exact minute, even had he been allowed to say what Mr. Hamilton told him, he couldn't say, this is what Mr. Hamilton said he was thinking at that exact
minute. Why don't you address the argument about the court precluding Hamilton's statements to Dr. Schmidt.
Okay. In the course of Dr. Schmidt's testimony, and again, this occurred outside the presence of the jury first, the prosecution objected to Dr. Schmidt testifying about what Mr. Hamilton told him, specifically about hallucinations that he'd been suffering and things that he'd been thinking and perceiving. And Dr. Schmidt... and the objection was that it was hearsay. And Dr. Schmidt said that he needed to explain what Mr. Hamilton said because otherwise his opinion was had no basis. The jury wouldn't have any way to evaluate whether he'd reached his conclusion rationally and appropriately. He would be able to say, yes, I talked to him. Yes, he told me things. Yes, I reached this conclusion. And sure, I think I'm right about it. But they couldn't evaluate his description of why that would be an appropriate conclusion without knowing that. Defense counsel in that case argued that it wasn't hearsay. They weren't offering Mr. Hamilton's statements to prove the truth of it. In fact, they were offering it essentially for the opposite, that it wasn't true, that he heard voices telling him certain things, that he felt certain bugs crawling on him, that he had these particular auditory and physical hallucinations. They were offering it as the basis of the doctor's opinion and as the basis upon which he was able to conclude that he did not think that these were signs of malingering or that they were made up. And the trial court ultimately concluded that it was hearsay and wouldn't let it in. That works in combination with the finger instruction. And I realize the court is saying, well, under the finger instruction, that he couldn't say what happened at the time, but he was able to tell Dr. Schmidt, I don't remember doing that. I remember being with her. I remember leaving. I don't remember this happening while I was there. So there is some lack of, at least some evidence of lack of knowledge of the act, not knowing the act he was committing because he was not perceiving what was happening. So there is at least a basis for him to be, under the first prong of finger, unaware of the nature of the act. That works in conjunction with this issue that you've just raised about Dr. Schmidt not being able to testify about what Mr. Hamilton said. The jury couldn't get a full explanation of what Mr. Hamilton said, how he described that event in particular, how he described, even though that particular window was missing right up to it and right after it, that he didn't recall it happening, that he remembered her being alive and well and didn't have any knowledge of his having done this.
But Mr. Hamilton was relating to the doctor and historical memory of supposedly a delusion. He wasn't experiencing a psychotic break in front of the doctor. So to the extent he's narrating, it is hearsay. Wouldn't you agree?
No, I wouldn't agree. The doctor was not saying that he wasn't going to opine that Mr. Hamilton did actually perceive this way or did actually have these particular hallucinations. He was opining that that those statements by Mr. Hamilton were not unreasonable in light of Mr. Hamilton's history. This one way to determine malingering is if the person has relates delusions that don't fit their background and their education and their experience. And so he was just wanted to describe that it fit within what he knew of Mr. Hamilton, what he learned of him. He was also giving his explanation for why he concluded that Mr. Hamilton actually did suffer psychosis and was suffering a psychotic break. Not that Mr. Hamilton actually perceived those things or actually felt that way. It was, as Dr. Schmidt described it, even the testing instruments, the standardized testing instruments, require the defendant's response in order to evaluate them. And if you can't give the response, the instruments wouldn't be valid. So he couldn't possibly reach his conclusion without hearing from Mr. Hamilton on those events. So,
but counsel, having said that, that kind of skirts the fundamental issue that defense has chosen between the existing exercising his right to testify and his right to be silent. And it puts us on a very thin beam in terms of what can come in and what can't come in. And we have some statements here that we can look at and we can analyze, and we have others that we don't have the backdrop for because we've just gotten this general statement as to statements. So what are we to do with this?
That's exactly the problem. The court should have that information. The jury should have had that information. If the trial court wanted to instruct the jury, you can't accept those statements.
But I understand that, but isn't that part of the defense and Mr. Hamilton making their decision on how they're going to deal with the charges?
You mean the fact that he did not testify at the trial itself himself?
Yes, and then you want his statements to come in anyway?
There are times and circumstances when they can, and that's what we're arguing, is that this is one of those times when they can't. They certainly had the choice to say, well, in that case, we'll put him on the stand and have him say it himself, and they didn't. But that doesn't change the legal argument about the statements at the time they were being offered. It was during the time when he had not yet testified, but it was not yet over. He still could have. At that time, even though he had not yet testified, they should have been admitted. They were admissible statements and should have come in. And without those, the doctor couldn't fully present his opinion. It undercut his basis
And you sponsored their admission purely as statements that the doctor relied on in forming his expert opinion. Do you have any other basis for securing admission of those statements?
That was what the trial counsel offered. They wanted them in as the basis of his opinion and his explanation.
We understand that the trial court reviewed the full doctor's report, but that wasn't provided to us.
I'm sorry? I didn't hear.
The trial court reviewed the underlying information that the doctor had formulated his opinion on, the full statements. However, for whatever reason, that wasn't provided to us to understand why the trial court made its decision.
I don't know. I don't recall why that would not have been provided in the record on appeal, because the clerk's office sends over everything. It must not have been admitted to the district court file. And I don't know the reason for that. I don't know if there was an objection. I just don't recall that as to why that wasn't provided. In either way, the jury wasn't given the full information. And with the problem with the finger McNaughton plus rule, not guilty by reason of insanity is going to be a problem in the state in all cases. The jury wasn't properly instructed in this case, and they weren't given the full information from Dr. Schmidt in order to be able to make their decision on his opinion of what happened. If there are any other questions at this time, I'd like to yield to Mr. Petty for the Batson issue.
Okay, Mr. Petty.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices of the Supreme Court. My name is John Petty. I'm here to address the sole issue of Batson that was raised during jury selection. As the court has read the record, the court will know that during jury selection, the prosecutor exercised two of his peremptory challenges to exclude or strike the only two African-American members of the jury panel, the first being Edith Moore and the second being Anthony Cleburne. When the prosecutor issued or made his first strike of Miss Moore, defense objected on Batson grounds, and the judge asked the prosecutor to state on the record his race-neutral reasons why he was excluding Miss Moore. And the reasons that he gave was, number one, he gave three reasons, the first being that she had expressed the view that, in her opinion, life without the possibility of parole in prison could be worse than the death penalty. The second reason he gave was that she somehow equivocated when asked if she assumed the role as jury foreman, could she sign the death verdict? And finally, third, that she knew a minister who was, or an individual who was going to be a defense witness, apparently, who's a minister. If you take each of those in turn and you review the record, you find the following. With regards to the first proffered reason that she had expressed a view about life without versus death, she was never asked that question. The record does not demonstrate that she was asked that question or she ever gave an answer to that. There was a Miss Morris who was asked questions, but not Miss Moore. She was never asked that question. So the record simply does not support that as a proffered reason, a race-neutral reason, to strike Miss Moore. The second reason that was given for Miss Moore is that she somehow was equivocal when asked whether she could sign the death verdict. Again, if you read the record, you see that she was anything but equivocal. She answered yes. In fact, everybody who was asked that question, and this was during the examination by the prosecutor, everyone that was asked that question, save for one person, and this was not Miss Moore, it was Miss Carlson, I believe, answered yes. Miss Carlson said no, she was removed for cause, and her replacement was also removed for cause for giving the same answer. But Miss Moore said yes. What Miss Moore was called upon to do, the court asked her to speak up, and she did. If you read the record, you see that the court had asked Miss Moore to speak up once before. Apparently, Miss Moore is a quiet person. But she did not equivocate. And even had the record shown some kind of equivocation on the part of Miss Moore, the record shows that the prosecutor did not bother to follow up with any kind of questioning of Miss Moore to explore with her that equivocation that he says is the basis for his reason to exclude her. This is interesting for two reasons, because another juror by the name of Miss Hellman The prosecutor did explore with her, did ask follow-up questions with her on this question of signing the death verdict. And Ms. Hellman at one point also apparently gave an answer the court didn't hear, and she had to, the court had to ask, well, what's your answer? What's interesting is that Ms. Hellman, a non-minority member, is a juror in Mr. Hamilton's case. Ms. Moore, who is an African-American, was stricken pursuant to the peremptory challenge by the prosecutor. So if you do a jury comparison analysis, you do a jury comparison analysis, it is odd that Ms. Moore's reason for being excluded does not operate effectively to exclude Ms. Hellman. So Ms. Hellman serves, Ms. Moore doesn't. That gives rise to a pretext. The first offered reason, since it's not supported in the record, gives rise to a pretext. So then we turn to the third reason for Ms. Moore's exclusion, and that is that she knew a minister. If you read the record, you see that during Judge Steinheimer's questioning of Ms. Moore, she asked the panel, does anybody know anybody up here on this list? And Ms. Moore volunteered that she knew Josh Devine, who apparently is a minister. She said it was not her minister, she knew him. She was asked by Judge Steinheimer, is there anything about knowing him that would affect your ability to judge him? No, she says. Again, had the prosecutor felt concerned about that answer, he could have followed up during his opportunity to do individual voir dire. He did not. I submit to you that with regards to Ms. Moore, each of the proffered reasons given, each of the proffered race-neutral reasons were pretext, and that basically Ms. Moore was excluded on the basis of race. And as this, the standard is that you look to the totality of relevant facts, if Ms. Moore were the only juror that was excluded, there's still an issue, but it is enhanced because the other black potential jury member, Mr. Claiborne, was also stricken by the prosecution. So when you take into consideration that 100% of the African-American population of that jury pool was excluded, you have to conclude that Ms. Moore's, or the reasons, the explanations for Ms. Moore's striking are pretext. The court should have, but did not, really engage in the third step of Batson, which is after hearing from the prosecutor's explanations, are they to be believed? Essentially, and we present this in our brief, essentially we believe Judge Steinheimer was of the opinion, and wrongly so, that if the state was able to offer a race-neutral reason for why they were excluding a minority member from the jury, that she simply had to accept it. And that's not the standard under the third prong of Batson. So we think Ms. Moore's exclusion is sufficient in and of itself because it is structural error. And this court said in Diamopo just last year, Diamopo v. State, structural error requires, Batson error is structural error, and structural error requires reversal. So Ms. Moore alone gives rise to reversal of this case, and we would ask the court to do that. We can turn and look at Mr. Claiborne, and the analysis is the same. You look at Mr. Claiborne, the two reasons offered for Mr. Claiborne. First, that he expressed the view that life without the possibility of parole could be worse than the death penalty. Three other non-minority members, and I have them listed in my brief, but three other non-minority members expressed similar or the same view as Mr. Claiborne, and they served on the jury on that issue. Mr. Claiborne was excluded. The second proffered reason for Mr. Claiborne being excluded was that his body language was unusual, that he rolled his eyes, that his demeanor was such that the prosecutor didn't believe that he would take his job seriously. Yet if you read the record, there is no indication that Mr. Claiborne did anything but answer the questions as best he could that were put to him by the court, the prosecutor, and defense counsel. And to the extent that the court might be inclined to say, well, that seems like a pretty good reason, I'm reminded that under Miller L. v. Drakey and other cases, that the fact that other proffered reasons do not hold up under judicial scrutiny militates against the sufficiency of the remaining reasons. So I think, again, under a totality of the facts test, if you look at the fact that the only two African-Americans of this jury panel were excluded by the prosecutor, the reasons offered simply don't hold up, they're not supported by the record, that the court clearly erred in sustaining overruling the Batson objections, this court, based on the structural error committed below, must remand this case back to the Second Judicial District Court for a new trial. And unless you have any other questions, I'll reserve my time.
What do you do with the court's statement that confirms the prosecutor's representation about Mr. Claiborne's apparently unusual body language? Because the court did make a statement confirming that. It's not as if there's nothing in the record to support that.
Correct. And if my argument was understood to say that there wasn't, I apologize. No, Judge Steinheimer did say, well, we did see him roll his eyes, and he does have some unusual body language. I think those are the words that she used. But having said that, even if you accept that as a particular reason why, or a single race-neutral reason why someone might, there might be a basis to uphold the prosecutor's peremptory challenge there, when you compare that against the fact that there really, when you read the record, there really isn't anything showing some kind of flippant attitude. Mr. Claiborne does answer the questions. And you compare that against the other proffered reasons, this court can conclude that as a totality result, the reasons given by the prosecutor are pretext, and that the true reason to exclude both Ms. Moore and Mr. Claiborne were based on race. And that violates the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. It constitutes structural error. It requires reversal.
Thank you for that clarification.
All right, Mr. Petty, thank you. Mr. Player?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Joe Plater on behalf of the state of Nevada. At the outset, the issues in this case really relate to whether Hamilton was afforded proper procedure. That's what he contends. He contends he wasn't given a constitutionally balanced or corrected jury because there was Batson error. He also claims he wasn't permitted to put on his insanity defense. So the first issue I want to address in terms of Batson is whether this court can review the credibility and the demeanor findings that the trial court made in reference to the prosecutor and to the struck jurors, and whether the court can review those type of determinations that the trial court made, and then whether the trial court abused its discretion in not permitting Hamilton to present any type of psychotic episode evidence that he wanted to support his alleged insanity defense. And then if there's time, I'll address some of the other issues the court said it was interested in its order. The court is well aware of the Batson framework. The defendant must put forth a prima facie case or some evidence of discrimination. Then the burden shifts to the state. The state has to offer race-neutral explanations for the strikes, and then the trial court should make a final determination as to whether the prosecutor has engaged in purposeful discrimination. The trial court, if it's not satisfied with the race-neutral explanation, can then engage in a pretextual analysis when it makes its final determination of whether there's been racial discrimination. It looks at four different things. The similarity of the answers between the jurors who were struck and those who weren't struck. It looks to see whether the DA's office has a history of purposeful discrimination against minorities. It looks to see whether the DA's office used a jury shuffle and whether there was disparate questioning by the state amongst all the potential jurors. Now, the trial court's decision, its ultimate decision on discriminatory intent, is a finding of fact that should be accorded great deference on review by this court. And the United States Supreme Court has told us that the credibility of the prosecutor's reasons can be measured by whether the proffered rationale has some basis in accepted trial strategy, and that the best evidence of a discriminatory intent by a prosecutor is often the demeanor of the prosecutor, and that a prosecutor's race-neutral reasons often invoke a juror's demeanor, such as nervousness, inattention, and things like that. These determinations of credibility and demeanor by the trial court lie peculiarly within the trial court's province. And a reviewing court must defer to those findings, absent exceptional circumstances. So the point is, reasonable minds might disagree about a prosecutor's credibility, about the demeanor of the jurors that are spoken to during the voir dire process, but the trial court's rulings about demeanor and credibility should be upheld unless there's some extraordinary reason otherwise. Now let me ask
this question about Batson. I've been an attorney and a judge now. It'll be 40 years in next November. And sitting on the bench in Clark County, I saw a lot of what I thought was purposeful discrimination. I'm not sure. I never sat in Washoe, so I'm not sure exactly how put any type of thing on the prosecutors in Washoe. Knowing that it's structural error if we find a Batson violation, knowing that, why would a prosecutor knock these two jurors off? I don't understand. Anything they said is that detrimental to a case that's as horrendous as this case. And it's just a horrible thing what happened to this young lady. Why would you risk knocking off the only two black jurors, the only two African Americans? I don't understand that. It's a risk. You're rolling the dice as a prosecutor. It's recklessness as far as I'm concerned in this particular case. Body language. Since when are judges any type of experts on body language? And I see people roll their eyes. These jurors roll their eyes all the time when I say things. They may have just rolled their eyes when I just said the things that I said. But why would you take a chance on a case like this? I mean, Batson, it certainly has those prongs, but body language, I have a lot of trouble with body language, especially if the person has to be black about body language. Because white people have body language too. And I rarely see a prosecutor, whether in Clark County or any place else since I've been on this court, knock a white person off because of body language. I'll let you respond. And I didn't mean to make a speech.
Well, whether it's good trial practice, whether it might be reckless, whether you're playing with fire as a prosecutor might be a valid consideration, as you suggested. But it's not the legal test as to whether there was purposeful discrimination in this case. Now, the reasons that the prosecutor used in striking Mr. Claiborne and Ms. Moore were that, in his mind, and by the objective things that he saw, which were confirmed by the trial court, they showed that these were not going to be jurors that he wanted on the panel.
But answer specifically what the defense attorney has raised about the Batson charge, about the pretext.
Okay.
What she said about the pretext, or what Mr. Petty said about the pretext.
Well, the first thing Mr. Petty said was that there were three jurors, Thomas, Palouche, and Albright. And he said, all three of these jurors were white, and they all said that a life sentence could be worse than a death penalty, and they weren't struck, so that's evidence of pretext. We suggest that's wrong. He's read the record wrong. None of those three white jurors who were not struck ever said that the death penalty could be, or that a life sentence could be worse than a death penalty. They just didn't say it. Here's what they said. And go back to the record. Well, Thomas never said anything like that whatsoever. Palouche and Albright both said that a death sentence and a life sentence could be equal to each other, but they never said a life sentence could be worse. So, there's a difference. When they equate the two sentences, then theoretically, they're going to impose a death sentence just as likely as they're going to impose a death sentence. So, there's a distinction there. The other distinction is that Albright said, which some of the other jurors didn't say, is that the punishment should fit the crime. And he also believed that legal insanity should not be a defense. So he clearly was not someone who was against the death penalty. Both Palouche and Albright said that they could sign a death verdict. Thomas said he believed in an eye for an eye and that the punishment should fit the crime. He said he would consider, based on the circumstances, another penalty other than the death penalty. But he didn't say anything about whether a life sentence could be worse than the death penalty. There's only one juror from our reading of the transcripts, and that was Ms. Ganschel, who said that a life sentence could be worse than the death penalty. And she was a white woman, and the prosecutor struck her. So when you do this comparative analysis, it doesn't hold up. It just, we read the record differently. Now, going back to Mr. or Ms. Moore, I want to clarify something that counsel's brought up. He said, well, the reasons that we used to justify the strike of Ms. Moore were reasons that were only given by Ms. Morris. Now, that's just a misreading of the record, or, I'll tell you what happened. The trial transcript identifies a Ms. Morris, but it's really Ms. Moore.
We've had that happen before, by the way, in this court. This is not a surprise to us.
So it was either stenographer's error, or it was an error in speaking on behalf of the people present in the courtroom. But it's clearly Ms. Moore that's addressed about her qualifications as a juror. And the reason is that there were two people who were identified with the last name of Morris. When the roll call was presented or was called in the court, there were two Morrises. There was a Randy Lee Morris and I think a Virginia Morris who said they were present. But from that group of jurors were called, when the group of jurors were called in the panel of jurors to be questioned, neither one of those Morris people were called forward. So there was no Morris on the panel who could have been examined. There was a Ms. Moore, which was the Moore in this case, who was called up. But more importantly, we know it's Ms. Moore, who's identified as Morris, because she earlier referred to her son having been murdered. And then later on, they go back to the person identified as Morris in the transcript, and she says, well, yeah, I'll talk about what I believe in terms of death penalty because I had a son who was murdered 16 years ago, and the defendant didn't get the death penalty. So it's clearly Ms. Moore that we're talking to, and not a Ms. Morris. So what Ms. Moore said was that she said that life, a life sentence without, could be worse than the death penalty. She raised her hand in agreement, according to the prosecutor, who said, or in agreement with another juror who said that a life sentence could be worse than the death penalty. Now, I agree the transcript or the record doesn't show whether she actually raised her hand in agreement with that juror, but the prosecutor said it and it was never challenged by the defense. She was equivocal about whether she could, or this is the prosecutor's reason, was that she was equivocal about whether she could sign a death verdict as a foreman, and she knew Hamilton's minister. Now, in and of themselves, these are race-neutral and therefore valid reasons why a prosecutor might strike somebody. Now, the argument that she knew the minister but had no reason to favor him in any which way, that may be true, but all Batson requires is that the prosecutor give a race-neutral reason why he's striking somebody. That reason doesn't have to be plausible. It doesn't have to be even persuasive, the court has told us. You just have to have a race-neutral reason. And so when the prosecutor sees somebody that is going to be, or sees a potential juror who knows one of the defense witnesses who actually did testify at the penalty stage, he doesn't necessarily have to believe that the juror is not telling the truth, that the juror won't necessarily have any bias in favor of the witness, but he may also know that human beings unconsciously tend to favor people that they might know when they testify. And we all know that people may unconsciously do that, even if they have expressly said, I won't favor that person's testimony over anybody else's. And so it's a valid reason that he used to strike her, because she knew somebody that was going to be a defense witness. Now, the evidence in the record supports the prosecutor's reasons for striking Ms. Moore. Besides knowing the minister, when the prosecutor asked Ms. Moore if she could sign a death verdict, according to the prosecutor, she looked down. And that's not a contested explanation from the prosecutor. She looked down. And at that point, the trial court said, quote, I didn't hear an answer, end quote. The prosecutor then said, quote, a little louder, end quote, at which point Ms. Moore said, yes. This supports a race-neutral explanation by the prosecutor that this potential juror was equivocal. In the prosecutor's mind, She was, quote, very equivocal, end quote, by her demeanor, body language, and the volume of her voice. The court has held that a juror's hesitance to impose the death penalty is a permissible race-neutral reason that justifies a peremptory challenge. That was in Kaczmarek v. 8. But going further, as far as Ms. Moore is concerned, potential juror Claiborne said during the voir dire process that life in prison could be worse than the death penalty. And at that point, the trial judge noticed Ms. Moore. And the trial judge commented, "Ms. Moore, you're nodding your head in agreement with that." And this is where the transcript refers Ms. Moore as Ms. Morris. And she said in response, "Yes." Then defense counsel asked Ms. Moore, quote, "Is that how you feel about it?" End quote. Ms. Morris said, "Yes, I feel that, in essence, a life sentence could be worse than the death penalty." And the reason was that she had a son who had been murdered some 16 years previously. The defendant was convicted. He didn't get the death penalty, but she said, you know what? He's paying for it every day of his life. It's something he has to live with. It is in mind for the rest of his life, and that's how he's paying for it. And she said, I now have some peace about it. Well, she's clearly expressing at that point some possible preference for a life sentence as opposed to the death penalty. At least the prosecutor could reasonably conclude that she could just as well be satisfied if somebody gets a life sentence as well as the death penalty. And so he's got a race-neutral and a valid reason for striking her at that point. It's important to note that during these proceedings, Hamilton did not object to any of the prosecutor's reasons that he gave for striking Ms. Moore. And what the trial court found was there's this argument that the trial court didn't meet the third step of Batson. It didn't make the specific finding that the prosecutor did not engage in purposeful discrimination. We disagree with that because at this point, after Ms. Morris, the trial court said that there were, quote, articulable reasons, end quote, other than race to challenge Ms. Moore, and that the prosecutor has a good faith basis as to the challenge. So that's saying much more than there are just race-neutral reasons to justify the exclusion. When the trial court says there's a good faith basis, the trial court's saying, I believe you, Mr. Prosecutor. Your basis is correct from what I've seen and heard, and therefore we're going to reject the Batson challenge. Now, as to Mr. Claiborne, the prosecutor said he challenged him for several reasons. The prosecutor said that Claiborne had said that a life sentence could be worse than the death penalty. And when Claiborne was talking about the different prison systems, Claiborne's nonverbal communication, including rolling his eyes several times, indicated that he didn't take the question seriously and that his answers were flip in tone and tenor. And so the prosecutor thought that Mr. Claiborne wouldn't take his jury duty seriously and he wouldn't deliberate with other jurors. We think the evidence in the transcript supports the prosecutor's reasons. When Claiborne was asked what he thought an eye for an eye meant, here was his answer, quote, it all sounds fair to me. It's all karma. It's going to come back at you, end quote. That's not committal to any type of idea what punishment should be. It's kind of a cavalier attitude. It's all going to come back to you. And then defense counsel asked him, well, would you consider something else other than the death penalty? He said, quote, sure, absolutely, end quote. And then the defense counsel said, well, does that reconcile with your opinion regarding eye for an eye? And he said, well, it depends on the prison system. I don't think somebody who commits a heinous crime should necessarily go to a minimum security prison. Then he says, quote, if he was guilty, I don't know, whatever, end quote. I couldn't help but think, it sounds like some of my teenage kids, whatever, Dad. You know? I mean, to me, when I read that, I think the prosecutor's justified in thinking this man may not appear to be very serious in his jury duty, and he just kind of is going to go along with whatever anybody says. And that is not only race neutral in its explanation, that by itself is a perfectly good reason why a prosecutor would strike somebody. Now, as far as the body language goes, Hamilton objected when the prosecutor said, you know, he's rolling his eyes, he appears too casual and cavalier. And defense counsel objected and said, well, that was merely the prosecutor's subjective view as to whether he had rolled his eyes. And at that point, the trial court interrupted and made an express finding as to demeanor, which was this. She said, quote, but we all saw it. He did it. His body language was unusual, end quote. And the trial judge continued, and she said, I wasn't happy when it happened. I wanted both of these jurors to be on the juror. That, I suggest, is a finding of demeanor by the trial court, which is supported by the prosecutor's observation and the trial court judge's observation. That finding of demeanor must be given deference by this court. In fact, I would go so far as to suggest this court can't even review that finding. You can't review it.
Why not?
Because, well, the Supreme Court has told us that. And the reason they've said
that. The Supreme Court has not been absolute. They've given us some deference, counsel.
No,
because when you start getting into demeanor, there's.
I'll explain why.
Please do.
I won't say it's an you cannot review demeanor evidence absolutely. The rule is you can't review it unless there's some extraordinary reason or circumstance.
Isn't life and death enough of an extraordinary reason to give us the ability to review it?
Well,
and I would add the determination of whether or not there was a proper race-neutral explanation being made.
What I'm saying is when a trial judge makes a finding about demeanor, it can't be reviewed because the cold record could never show what the demeanor was. Now, if the trial court relied on a pretextual reason for making that demeanor finding, yes, it can be reviewed. For example, if the trial court judge said, well, he rolled his eyes, therefore, I find he wasn't going to take his responsibilities seriously. Because as we all know.
But counsel, that's a major jump and a major conclusion. As Justice Cherry pointed out earlier in terms of some of us sometimes rolling our eyes at reference to his question, that does not mean we don't take our obligations seriously. It just means we happen to roll our eyes. So there are issues there that I think we have the ability to look at, but as Justice Sata said, we have to look at the totality of what is being presented,
right,
not just singularly one point.
So I think, though, when a prosecutor sees somebody rolling their eyes several times, it's reasonable for them to conclude that, given human nature, that's often an expression of disinterest. And so the question is,
counsel, jurors very seldom come in and sit down and raise their hand and say, I want to do this, especially when it's a death penalty, because all of a sudden it's not cocktail conversation about I'm going to sentence someone to death. It is real. Even if they think that person deserves death, it is real. It is no longer play.
I agree. And people, the point I'm making is that people can make an inference either way. You could infer from somebody's rolling their eyes, depending on the context and the situation, that doesn't mean anything. It may mean the person is genuinely interested in what's going on, but it's just as reasonable to infer, given what we know about the human condition and how we respond to each other, given body language and so forth, that a person who rolls their eyes might be completely uninterested and cavalier as well. There are competing inferences, I agree, that can be made from body language. In this case, the prosecutor made an inference that he didn't appear particularly interested. And I think that's supported by what else Mr. Claiborne said during the voir dire practice. That finding is difficult for this court to review because, as I said, there's nothing on the cold record to show what the what actually happened. We weren't there. We didn't see it. That's not to say you can't review it, but the Supreme Court has told us that there must be some extraordinary circumstance that would be needed to overrule the trial court's finding of demeanor. Such an example might be where if the trial court said, you know, he rolled his eyes, I find that's a really a cavalier attitude, because after all, we all know that women or blacks or whatever unconstitutional reason might be given have a tendency to engage in such behavior. And that would be, you could review that and find that that finding was improper because they used an improper classification, an unconstitutional classification to make the finding. And it was a pretext to say that they were relying on body language, such as rolling the eyes. So.
If you're finished with Batson, I'd like to ask you a question about McNaughton and Finger.
Sure.
Just a quick question as to whether an expert's testimony as to the delusions that the person had is hearsay. When delusional beliefs can only be the grounds for legal insanity, when the facts of the delusion, if true, would justify the commission of the criminal act, how do you get it out if the defendant doesn't testify? How would you say, as a prosecutor, you needed to get it out that the delusion has no affirmative defense to it, and so insanity wouldn't apply? How would you get it out if you can't have that doctor testify, that psychiatrist testify?
Well, let's be clear about, because this brings up a point that's been argued this morning. And it's been argued that the trial court prohibited Dr. Schmidt from giving his opinion whether Hamilton was insane. That is untrue. That is simply not the case. The trial court never prohibited Dr. Schmidt from giving his opinion whether this man was insane or not. Because if it did, I'd be confessing error. And I would almost go so far as to say, as I give up, let's all go home. Except for the fact that Dr. Schmidt said, I can't find any insanity. Well, he didn't say that. He said, I can't say that the man is insane. But if we didn't have that, I'd say that's reversible error. Of course he can come in and give his opinion. The trial court did not preclude him from doing that. In fact, the trial court said he can give any opinion that he has based on his interviews, the testing he's done, the opinions of other medical professionals. But that's how you get the opinion out. He could have offered his opinion that Mr. Hamilton was insane or not insane, but he said he couldn't go that far because he didn't have the information. There was no evidence there. So he could have come in as an expert, and he could have relied on the hearsay statements of anybody, including Hamilton, in rendering that opinion. For example, Rule 703 of the Federal Rules of Evidence says that an expert may rely on inadmissible evidence in forming an opinion and expressing that opinion to a jury. But the rules expressly also says that doesn't give the expert license to then give all of the inadmissible evidence to the jury, such as hearsay statements. Now, the judge can fashion a rule where the statements may come in if it does a proper balancing test and gives a proper jury instruction. But because an expert can rely on inadmissible evidence and forming the opinion, doesn't mean that the expert gets to come in and then give the jury that inadmissible evidence. There has to be a rule of evidence that allows those hearsay statements to come in. And Hamilton's statements were hearsay, frankly. When they want him to come in, and especially when they want to come in, as you said, Justice Pickering, to give a historical account of what happened, that's clearly hearsay. But whether or not the trial court abused its discretion in not permitting Dr. Schmidt to relate all of Hamilton's hearsay statements is not that important of an issue anyways, because Dr. Schmidt expressly testified that he didn't have any statements to give to the jury about what Hamilton told him at the specific time of the crime, because Hamilton told Schmidt he didn't remember the time period. There was nothing to give. There were no statements of Hamilton to be admitted. And the defense has never given us what those statements allegedly were that should have come in through Dr. Schmidt about what happened at the moment of the crime.
So as a prosecutor, if the defense psychiatrist says, Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I find this defendant to be insane under the McNaughton test and under Finger. And then no further questions from the defense attorney. As a prosecutor, you wouldn't have to say, well, let's talk about what he told you. You would have to bring out the hearsay
right.
to at least to see whether that that right. prong of Finger is
right.
met.
Right.
So it would come in. Those delusions would come in, if there were delusions.
It could under cross-examination. And Schmidt was given full leeway to give his opinion about any delusion also. We take issue with what he was allowed and not allowed to do. About qualifying the Finger test, we just disagree about what the court said in Finger. Our reading is that Finger said we're going to follow the McNaughton test, and McNaughton is satisfied in one of two ways. And this additional language that is now being argued, the court somehow strapped on to McNaughton, our reading is that that's not additional language or an additional requirement that the court put on the McNaughton test. That example that is referred to is merely an example of how a defendant might satisfy the second test of McNaughton. That's all it is. But again, it wouldn't matter because the McNaughton test was clearly not met in this case. And the defense has never said, Hamilton's never said, what evidence there is out there that could have been put forward to meet the insanity test had our expert been allowed to do so, and had we been allowed to cross-examine Dr. Kienhouse correctly. Again, it wouldn't matter because of what the jury was instructed. The jury was instructed properly under McNaughton. So we would respectfully ask the court to affirm the judgment of conviction.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Plater. Ms. Bond, were you going to rebut, or Mr. Petty, or did you have anything you wish to say? I'll give you 1 minute.
Thank you for the time. I just want to respond to a couple of matters. If I read the record wrong and it is Ms. Morris is, in fact, Ms. Moore, I apologize to the court, but it doesn't change the analysis because the rationale is the same as used against Mr. Claiborne, which is that he felt the life without was a worse, could be a worse penalty than the death penalty. And I asked the court to take the time to read Volume 8, pages 1900 through 1906, which is defense counsel's exploration with Mr. Claiborne, Ms. Morris, Mr. Albright, Ms. Polish, Mr. Thomas, and just do a comparison of the answers that were given, and you'll see that they are virtually identical. They may be phrased in different terminology, but the answers are basically the same, and the difference is, when this jury was constructed, Mr. Claiborne and Ms. Moore were not members of the panel, but three juror members who expressed the same view, nominating members, were. And we believe that by a jury comparable jury analysis, that shows a discriminatory purpose, and we ask the court reverse this conviction.
Okay, thank you, counsel, for your excellent briefs and arguments this morning. The case will stand submitted. We'll be in recess until 11:30.